it nothing to do with the wife of such a foolish man. But instead of filling up this rejected space with insecurity, she found stability by filling it with grace. The more she hurt, the more she learned how to help others who were hurt. In this situation, she figured out a way to give David not only festive food, but also the kindness Nabal had denied him. She gave to him out of her own lack, from the empty places in her heart that God so graciously filled. With an enormous space for grace, she approached David, the man about to kill her family and her servants, and quickly bowed down before him. "I want this. But boy, is it hard to live like this in the heated moment of hurt. I'm stunned by how well Abigail lived this. I find myself trying to resist grace in her story. After all, her first words to David seem so beyond what my own feelings would have allowed in this situation. On me alone, my Lord, be the blame." 1 Samuel 25:24. I read this and clench my jaw. I've grown so fond of her, I absolutely refuse to be okay with her owning any part of this. Cast the blame on Nabal. He's the jerk in this story. Or place the blame on David. He's the hot-headed one here. But not Abigail. She's already had to wrestle under the weight of an unfair life. Now she has to step in between her ridiculous husband and a hungry, crazed David to take on blame that clearly wasn't hers to bear. She's the victim. She's the one who, in the middle of getting ready for a festival, had normal ripped right out from her midst. One minute she's making out her Target and Hobby Lobby errands list, and the next minute a servant comes and announces disaster is hanging over her household. But instead of bowing to anger, cynicism, blame, all too often the fruits of living rejected, she chooses grace. How did she process this in such a healthy way? Had she some tweaking of the soul? Some vision of the bitter box reeking of rot that deterred her from walking toward it? I don't know these details, but I do see an immediate cooperation with grace. Her giving grace doesn't justify her husband or validate David. It saves her. It makes David stop cold in his heated tracks. It makes the men, pulsing with swords in their hands and death on their minds, pause. I can almost see their arms full of weapons and their bodies full of testosterone tremble. What a scene. Though Abigail is bowed low, grace gives her the upper hand. She refuses to be a victim of a circumstance she can't fully change. Instead, she changes what she can. It's impossible to hold up the banners of victory and victim at the same time. With victory in mind, she bows low before David and with great courage allows the mantle of blame to be placed on her shoulders. After all, she's the only one strong enough to handle it. The humiliation of being married to a man named Fool had secretly worked something good deep within Abigail's soul. The more she cooperated with grace, the more her humiliation turned into humility. Humility can't be bought at a bargain price. It's the long working of grace upon grace within the hurts of our hearts. Humility gave Abigail the greatest advantage in this life and death conversation with David. Humility opens the ears of opportunity. In the next chapter, we'll unpack her amazing conversation with David. Abigail's grace-filled words are what I believe to be one of the greatest speeches of the Bible. After all, here we sit talking about it thousands of years later. And instead of the screams from a sidewalk, it's her words that echo into the deep places of our hearts. Chapter 8, The Corrective Experience. I got an email this morning that made my heart sink. "I am turning in my resignation because I do not agree with the new direction you are taking our committee. I shared my thoughts at the last meeting, but it is obvious you and I see things differently." Ouch. What a major bummer to wake up to. Especially because when I talked to this fellow committee member last week, I thought we were really starting to see eye to eye. Due to budget cuts, we needed to change some of our original plans for the school event we were organizing. But this didn't sit well with this person. She wanted to charge more for the tickets to cover the extra cost. I totally understood her point. We had worked really hard on our original plan, and this change would cause us to have to go back to the drawing board, putting a lot more work on us. So yes, I understood her frustration. But as I processed requiring people to pay more, I realized some parents wouldn't be able to afford this change. And I didn't want anyone to have to tell their kids they couldn't come because of the cost. I recommended scaling back our plans rather than having some kids be unable to attend. I thought she agreed with me, but apparently from her latest email, she didn't. And on top of that, I got the distinct impression she was quite angry and frustrated with me. I put my head down on the kitchen table and sighed. I had woken up happy and ready to regroup with my committee to make the best of a hard budget situation. It was already going to be a challenge to do what needed to be done, but I'd rallied in my heart and believed we could get creative and things would still turn out just fine. Now I just felt defeated. Every bit of my creative energy started draining out of what felt like holes drilled in my heart. I was trying to do a good thing volunteering to lead this committee, but now I felt all it had done was add drama to my life. I started questioning, am I a bad leader? Do the other members want to resign too? What if they all quit and I'm left to do this alone? I can't do this alone. What started off as a day full of potential turned into me feeling like a rejected failure. All from one email. Good gracious. I pressed the sides of my head and willed my eyes to refuse the production of tears. I felt horrible and then mad. And then penned in by circumstances beyond my control. But most of all, I just felt incredibly misunderstood. Should I call the writer of the email and try to talk it through some more? Or just leave it alone? Ugh, why do I care so much? Of course I should care so much. It all just felt like a tangled mess. I wish I could tell you that this was an isolated situation. But these kind of tangled messes seem to go hand in hand with trying to get different people on the same page. Different people with differing perspectives will find themselves in difficult situations unless they determine to discuss things well. Relationships don't come in packages of perfection. Relationships come in packages of potential. They have the potential to be great. They also have the potential to be hard at times. No matter what, it takes work to make it work. And wrapped in between the wonderful and the work are inevitable times of imperfection and possible rejection. That's just part of it. But I'm determined to examine how I can have better conversations in the future when differing opinions are involved. The first thing I realized I could have done better in this situation was to start from a me too place rather than from a you should or you could place. This me too says to the other person, I hear you, and I see the validity in your feelings because I've had those feelings before too. A couple of years ago, I was helping a friend with some book writing tips. As I read his first chapter, I realized he was writing in the way that would not draw the reader in because he jumped right into preaching and teaching. As a reader, I didn't need that. I needed a friend who understood the struggle being addressed in the book. If writers don't show me their struggles, I can't trust their advice. I don't want theories that smell like a library. I want advice to smell like it has some real life in it. I want to know that what they are writing about has worked on their own issues, so I can believe it might work on mine. Take away the struggle, and you take away my trust. I advise my writing friend to shift his approach from you should or you could to me too. And it made all the difference in his book feeling more accessible and approachable. Maybe the same is true when having a difficult conversation with someone of a differing opinion. If I approach that person first with a you should attitude, it will feel like I'm wagging my finger and preaching at her. You should consider. You should think of. You should have more compassion for. You should have told me. You should have never. This will instantly put her on the defensive and bait her to build a case against me. This happens when I'm more concerned about making my point than making progress. And almost worse, if I approach her with a you could attitude, it will feel like I'm trying to teach her a lesson that I'm not willing to apply myself. You could be more willing to. You could think of this differently by. You could be more sensitive to. You could stop this. You could start that. This will instantly position me as the expert and her as the less experienced student. When put in this unwelcomed position, people usually withdraw, shut down, and in the case of my friend on the committee, resign. I hadn't meant to assume she needed me to teach her a lesson about being sensitive to other parents' finances. I was just passionate about helping her think of this situation from all sides. But obviously, the you should or you could approach wasn't working. Me too puts us on the same team. It says, we are in this together, so let's attack the problem, not each other. Now, just as a point of clarification, saying me too must come with three guidelines of what this is not meant to do. It is not a tactic we should use to steal the spotlight. It's not saying, oh, me too, now let's process all my hurt. It's not something we should use to one-up their hurt. It's not saying, me too, except if you think what you're going through is difficult, let me show you what real difficulties are. And lastly, it is not a validation of their actions that spring from their feelings. It's simply acknowledging their feelings and identifying with them, if you can authentically do that. Abigail is such a good example of me too done right. In 1 Samuel 25, she was brilliant in her approach with David. She acknowledged right away that her husband had acted foolishly toward him. But the way she said it let David know Abigail was a victim of Nabal's foolishness as well. His name is fool, and folly goes with him everywhere he goes. 1 Samuel 25:25 paraphrased. This was Abigail's Me Too statement. Though she didn't use the words Me Too, she certainly used the sentiment of this powerful two-word statement. By stating that folly goes with Nabal everywhere, she made it clear that Nabal's foolishness wasn't just directed at David. It flowed in every direction of his life and impacted everyone with whom he interacted. And by everywhere, she clearly meant in his home and with her. A woman's eyes often hold conversations within their stare. And I imagine Abigail's eyes gently communicated some version of these statements. He's treated you poorly, David. Me too. I understand. He didn't think about caring for you, David. Me too. I understand. He didn't appreciate what you've done for him, David. Me too. I understand. And she brilliantly knew something else as well. She knew David wasn't looking for a lesson. He was looking for food and respect. Before addressing his issues, she came prepared to acknowledge his need. Even this was a Me Too statement. You feel you and your men more than deserve festive food in return for your kindness in watching Nabal's flocks? Me too. I agree you and your men deserve food. The second thing I'm beginning to realize as I process a better way of communication is clearly stating you do belong. Me too communicates to a person she is understood. You do belong communicates she is accepted. Acceptance is like an antibiotic that prevents past rejections from turning into present-day infections. The need for belonging runs deep. The need to belong goes beyond the need for superficial social ties. It's a need for meaningful, profound bonding. A sense of belongingness is crucial to our well-being. The lack of belongingness causes various undesirable effects, including a decrease in the levels of health, happiness, and adjustment. I believe what pushed my committee member to respond by immediately resigning was the sudden feeling her ideas were no longer heard, and therefore she didn't have a place on our team. No more feeling of contribution, no more feeling of belonging. And maybe this wasn't the first time she'd felt that way. Most of us have been made to feel like we don't belong at some point in our lives. It's a bummer to be left out, not chosen, and overlooked. But when someone of great significance in our lives makes us feel like our belonging is more of a question mark than a security blanket, we become very sensitive to even the slightest hints of rejection. The wound is reopened, and rejection's infection sets in. For David, it wasn't just that Nabal rejected his request for food. Nabal rejected him as a person and a leader. Who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? Many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I take my bread and water and the meat I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men coming from who knows where? David's men turned around and went back. When they arrived, they reported every word. 1 Samuel 25:10-12. Nabal's dismissal of David conveyed, "You are not known. You don't belong. You aren't important. You are not valuable. You are not secure." The minute David's men recounted Nabal's jarring words, David went from a man hungry for food and recognition to a man hungry for revenge. His reaction was quick, aggressive, and extreme. Too extreme, don't you think? I mean, after all, David was denied the equivalent of a hamburger and water, and he's ready to kill over that? But it really wasn't about the food at all. Extreme reactors are usually dealing with compounding factors. Nabal's words struck an existing wound. Nabal wasn't the originator of David's wound, but he certainly hit it dead on when he rejected David and his request. I believe the deep wound was caused years before by David's father, Jesse. In 1 Samuel 16, when the prophet Samuel went to Jesse, asking him to bring before him all his sons, he did just that, with one exception. He left David out in the field. Either he had totally forgotten about David, or he held him in such disregard that he never thought David had a chance to be the chosen one. Why bring him in? Either way, that's hurtful. Jesse had 7 of his sons pass before Samuel, but Samuel said to him, "The Lord has not chosen these." He asked Jesse, "Are these all the sons you have?" "There is still the youngest," Jesse answered, but he... I won't put assumptions in Jesse's words. I know what he goes on to say. He is tending the sheep. However, I think this is one of the lamest excuses he could give for not including David in what was surely the biggest event this family had ever taken part in. If David's father had any regard for his youngest son at all, he could have found someone else to temporarily tend the sheep. I suspect that behind that statement were some thoughts like, "Well, yes, I have one more son, the youngest, David, but he doesn't look like a king, doesn't act like a king, doesn't smell like a king, so I didn't invite him." Uninvited by his own father. Can you imagine how David must have felt when they finally went to get him, and he stumbled into this event fresh from the field? "Dad brought everyone else but me." And with an emotional dagger steaming with red-hot rejection, David's father inflicted a mark on his heart that read, "You don't belong. You don't matter as much as your brothers. You aren't important enough to be remembered. You are not valuable enough to be considered. You are not secure with this family who disregards you." Even though Samuel went on to anoint David as the future king, I can't find where Jesse ever tended to his son's heart. Isn't it crazy that on the same day David achieved the ultimate success of being named the future king, he was overlooked by his father? No amount of outside achievement fixes inside hurts. Those hurts have to be soothed by replacing the lies with truth. Can't you just hear Satan's cackle as Nabal pokes at that same wound still pulsing with pain from David's father's rejection? But then the ominous screams of evil give way to the sweet harmony of healing through Abigail. When Abigail talked with David, she did the exact opposite of what Nabal did, and the opposite of what Jesse did. She reinstated a feeling of belonging in David. Her words were gentle, honoring, and life-giving. And most of all, they were filled with God's truth. "Please forgive your servant's presumption. The Lord your God will certainly make a lasting dynasty for my Lord, because you fight the Lord's battles, and no wrongdoing will be found in you as long as you live. Even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, the life of my Lord will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God, but the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling." 1 Samuel 25:28-29. She spoke her words of truth in the tone of grace. After all, remember, David was leading a mob of 400 men with drawn swords to kill Nabal and all the males who belonged to him. And there were 200 others who had stayed back to watch the supplies, but were just as thirsty for bloody revenge. But that's not who David was at his core. David was a man who belonged to God. Abigail spoke to who he was, not to how he was acting in the moment. You are a fighter of the Lord's battles. You are known. You matter to the Lord. The Lord has a plan for your dynasty to last. You are important. Someone is pursuing you to take your life, but God has a plan to keep you safe. You are valuable. Remember what God did when you hurled that stone from the pocket of a sling towards Goliath. God was faithful that day and is faithful this day too. You are secure. Abigail soothed the deep wound Nabal had reopened. In counseling terms, this is called the corrective experience. She revisited the hurt place of David's heart with healing words that corrected or rewrote the lies that had wounded him so deeply. Did Abigail know of David's wound? There's a chance she'd heard of Jesse's actions toward David on the day of his anointing. He wasn't an anonymous figure, he was the future king, and she makes it clear during her speech that she knew his royal destiny. But what she saw herself was that David's reaction surely had more hurt behind it than simply what Nabal had caused. Isn't that true of most of us? If we react with more emotion than is appropriate for an isolated incident, it's probably not so isolated. The escalated emotion of this situation is probably an indication of painful ties to the past. I believe this was true of David. Where David's father and Nabal had spoken death, with divinely inspired words, Abigail spoke life. Each of her statements called forth the truth of his identity and quieted the lies of the enemy. And as a result, he changed. He felt safe enough to listen to her. He felt safe enough to take the food she brought him. He felt safe enough to turn back to his men and retract the plan he'd so boldly declared to kill Nabal. And most of all, he felt safe enough to believe and receive God's message through Abigail. Me too, and you do belong, are powerful words. Not just for Abigail and David, but for all of us. These are soothing statements that calm and heal. Beautiful realities for us to receive from God personally and believe. And they are incredible truths to stick in our back pockets as gifts to be given in conversations with others. Let your past rejection experiences work for you instead of against you by allowing them to help you sense the possible pain behind other people's reactions. Try to see things from their vantage points and think how they might be hurting in this situation. Even if you don't agree with their stance or their reaction, find a way to identify with their hurt. Most people are walking around with way more hurts from their past than we can ever imagine. Pretty much everyone has at some point been deeply hurt by someone. That's your me too. Then make a list of good things you know to be true about that person, like I did in chapter 6. This doesn't validate her actions in the moment, but it will validate her worth as a person. Even if you are clueless about the past hurts that could be feeding her reaction, you can still be sensitive to her obvious pain. You will be an agent of grace in her life as you whisper, "You do belong." And all of this will help you stop the cycle of rejection and hurt in the other person's life and in your life. On that note, I guess now I'll go respond to that resignation email. I don't know everything I'll say, but you bet me too. And you do belong, will now be part of it. Chapter 9. Why does rejection hurt so much? Lisa, we have to go in a different direction than we originally thought. We saw your great potential, but there was another candidate better qualified for this opportunity. Silence. Complete and utter silence hung in the air as my brain refused to bring forth anything appropriate to say. I had to be professional. I didn't want to validate further their obvious doubt about me, and I knew I'd regret doing anything that betrayed my relationship with Jesus. But I wasn't feeling very spiritually motivated in this moment of utter shock. They'd already committed to me. I'd told people. I'd posted about it on social media. I'd been so excited. And now, in one unexpected phone call, this opportunity I'd been so excited about was shut down. With a total display of brilliance and intelligence, I uttered, "Okay, sure, well, I'm okay." There was an awkward exchange of pleasantries and something about the weather and a totally flat-sounding promise of being in touch with me about future projects, and that was that. My hands and lips felt completely numb. I brushed at the crumbs on the table. I picked at a hangnail until it bled, willing it to make me feel something other than the stabbing sensation in my chest. I wanted to cry, but I didn't want to cry. I wanted to scream, only I definitely didn't want to scream. I wanted to call them back and beg for their reconsideration. However, I absolutely did not want to call them back and beg for anything. I wondered if I might be teetering on the edge of a panic attack. Should I get a brown paper bag and breathe in some sort of calming rhythm? I'd have to YouTube the details on this. I clearly was handling this like a champ, and it seemed my reaction only further confirmed why I totally should have been rejected by them, which only made me feel worse. I wish I could say I got up and went for a run, or read my Bible, or went to pull weeds, something productive that I could later cheer about and say, "Yay me, look at how well you handled that." But no. Instead, I hopped on the internet to see if I could figure out who they'd chosen over me. My brain kept saying to stop this right now, but my curiosity and fingers wouldn't cooperate. And it didn't take long for me to see in pixelated detail her perfect smile, confident stance, and impressive list of accomplishments. And though they hired her for her Bible brilliance and probably never even noticed her thin legs, I totally noticed. Of course she had thin legs. Salt in my worst wound. Her jeans didn't appear to pull and beg for mercy like mine do on the regular, and I'm certain hers didn't have those little fabric pills on the inner thigh region because she had, hold the phone, a slight thigh gap. The thigh gap did me in. Totally. Don't judge me. I'm not at all a proponent of thigh gaps. As a matter of fact, I'm against them. Totally. It's quite obvious. Lord, have mercy on all that jiggles on me, and my soul, and my obviously whacked out brain. Time for rationality to kick in. I stood at my full-length mirror and tried to manipulate a thigh gap. If I turned my toes in just so and pushed my backside out a tad and begged my hips to pretend to adjust to an unrealistic angle and forced my knees to bow, then voila! For one brief millisecond, a sliver of light appeared. But my inner thighs have some sort of magnetic attraction determined to flop them back together, like birds of a feather. Make that a fluffy feather. I'm completely sane, except when I'm the opposite of that. This situation messed me up for days. I felt utterly squashed inside my heart and squishier than ever around my thighs. Although, honestly, this had nothing at all to do with my thighs or hers. It just made me feel better to attribute being uninvited to something trivial, because then I simply roll my eyes at the shallowness of it all. But it wasn't for shallow reasons that I was uninvited. It was that the committee determined she was a better fit for their event. And you know what really felt like an utter betrayal? I knew God could fix this. And he didn't. Rejection is so incredibly painful. Rejection piggybacks on physical pain pathways in the brain. MRI studies show that the same areas of the brain become activated when we experience rejection as when we experience physical pain. This is why rejection hurts so much, neurologically speaking. In fact, our brains respond so similarly to rejection and physical pain that Tylenol reduces the emotional pain rejection elicits. In a study testing the hypothesis that rejection mimics physical pain, researchers gave some participants acetaminophen, Tylenol, before asking them to recall a painful rejection experience. The people who received Tylenol reported significantly less emotional pain than subjects who took a sugar pill. Strange facts like this fascinate me, but it didn't comfort me. I was pretty sure no Tylenol would help. This went beyond just rejection from man. That is hard. But what's downright horrible is when God seems to just silently stand by withholding answers and solutions for which you've cried out. That deep hurt can make you question his goodness. This situation was small in comparison to other rejections I faced, but it tapped into a raw emotional place of other unresolved hurts. A deep well holding tears from many other times when someone said, "You're not good enough." Rejection isn't just an emotional feeling. It's a message that alters what you believe about yourself. And the minute you sense that happening is the minute you must stop the runaway thinking with truth. I needed to shift my thinking, not only in order to process Thigh Gap Girl's success well, but also to make sure I didn't internalize a lie about my identity and then miss what God was doing here despite his seeming silence. God is always at work. He is a present, loving Father, aware of our deepest hurts and our even deeper needs. We aren't always able to see this clearly. Still, even when it seems otherwise, we must remember that sometimes when we feel rejected and passed over for someone else, when God seems busy elsewhere or even purposefully unmoving, the truth is, he is at work, maybe doing something entirely beyond what we were thinking. You aren't set aside. Not too long after being uninvited to the conference I just told you about, I received an invitation to a leaders gathering. I was so thankful. I just knew I'd be able to swap stories with the other attendees about their uninvited moments, and it would totally make me feel more normal. Yes, there were many feelings I thought I'd have at this small conference I was so looking forward to attending. Acceptance, fun, camaraderie. On paper, these were my people. They led organizations. I led an organization. They were vulnerable. I was vulnerable. Like me, they knew the public pressures that feed our private insecurities. They knew the stresses of deadlines, trying to balance kids with ministry, and the nagging sense that we should keep hidden the fact that we have the pizza delivery place on speed dial. Yes, these would for sure be my people. And the great thing about gathering with people with whom you just know you are going to bond is that they will get you. Really get you. Like on the level of having inside jokes that make every conversation comfortable and delightful. I couldn't wait to be with these people. And I couldn't wait for the deep friendships that would surely bloom as a result of our time together. I walked into the room and quickly found the people I was excited to meet. Every seat had a name tag attached, so I circled the table looking for mine. As I got to the last chair and realized my name wasn't there, I had a sinking feeling. I milled around the room looking for my name, feeling increasingly out of place. Finally, at a table on the opposite side of the room, I found it. I rallied in my heart that the Lord must have a special plan for me to meet and connect with the others assigned to my table. I took my seat and pulled out my cell phone, nervously waiting for my table mates. I waited and waited and waited. As the prayer for the meal concluded and the event got well underway, it was painfully apparent the others assigned to my table weren't able to come for some reason. I'd be seated alone. Very alone. In reality, I don't think anyone else really noticed my predicament. After all, by this point, everyone in the room was busy passing rolls and salad dressing options. In my head, I started to have a little pity conversation. "Well, self, would you like a roll? Or 10, perhaps? It's certainly an option when you're sitting single at a table for 10. And that's when a very clear sentence popped into my head. "You aren't set aside, Lisa. You are set apart." It wasn't audible, and it wasn't my own thought. I knew it was a thought assigned by God that I needed to ponder. To be set aside is to be rejected. That's exactly what the enemy would have wanted me to feel. If he could get me to feel this, then I'd become completely self-absorbed in my own insecurity and miss whatever the reason God had for me to be at this moment. To be set apart is to be given an assignment that requires preparation. That's what I believe God wanted me to see. If he could get me to understand this, I'd be able to embrace the lesson of this situation. And the lesson of being uninvited from the other event. And just a solid lesson for life in general. The lesson was this. Anything that infuses us with humility is good. Even if it feels a bit like humiliation in the moment, The workings of humility within are a gift. The tweaking of us by God in the quiet is the saving of us in public. The only difference between humility and humiliation is that one chose to bow low while the other tripped and fell there. Either way, the sweetest grace lifted my face, and I saw that on the other side of the stripping of pride are some of the best gifts God gives us. The Bible reminds us that on the other side of humility, we find wisdom. Proverbs 11:2. We will be lifted up by God himself in due time. 1 Peter 5:6. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. James 4:6. Humility isn't a place of weakness, but rather a position that will come with honor. Proverbs 18:12. And humility is an absolute requirement for those who ask God to heal their land. 2 Chronicles 7:14. Yes, rejection is humbling to the point of humiliation. But sweet friend, don't let rejection steal one more thing from you. Receive the little-known gifts of rejection that can work good in your life if you so choose. Here are three of those gifts I've embraced. The gift of being made less. When we decrease, God has room to make big things happen. We are reminded of this in John 3:28 through 31, as John the Baptist is insisting to his followers that he is not the anointed one. I am the one who comes before him. He, the groom, must take center stage, and I, the best man, must step to his side. Imagine what everyone would miss at a wedding if the best man refused to let the groom take his place. The radiant bride only walks down the aisle when she knows her groom is at the end ready to receive her. Then the glorious wedding happens. When writing on this passage, Eugene Peterson says, "That's why my cup is running over. This is the assigned moment for him to move into the center, while I slip off to the sidelines." In the sidelines setting apart place, God will give you a special wisdom you'll need for the next assignment. We'll take a look at this on a practical level in just a minute, but first, humility gifts 2 and 3. The gift of being lonely. This will develop in you a deeper sense of compassion for your fellow travelers. But in addition to the blessing of compassion being developed in me, those lonely times also seem to be when Jesus lavishes his most intimate compassion on me. Isn't it interesting that Jesus seemed to speak most intimately to people who were lonely? I doubt his conversation with the Samaritan woman at Jacob's well in John 4 would have been the same if she'd been with a group of people. And we see a similar kind of personalized message for the woman caught in adultery in John 8. He didn't speak to her personally and intimately until the others left. Both of these women were alone, not just physically, but emotionally and spiritually. We see them in extremely lonely and humbling situations. We see their aloneness. When we see Jesus step into their loneliness and lavish his compassion on them, and certainly with the Samaritan woman, a compassion for the others in her town emerged in her. This is certainly what happens in my life as well. The conversations I have with the Lord in my loneliest always lead me to more intimacy with him and more compassion for others. You better believe when I walk into a conference now, I look for someone sitting alone and make sure she knows she is noticed. When I ease the loneliness stink in others, it is beautifully eased in me. The gift of silence. Had I been surrounded by the voices of those people I was so eager to meet that night, I would surely have missed the voice of God. I'm trying to weave more silence into the rhythm of my life now so I can whisper, "God, what might you want to say to me right now? I'm listening." Ecclesiastes tells us, "There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens, a time to be silent and a time to speak." 3:1-7. I've got to spend time getting quiet so I can be prepared to hear new things from the Lord. Isn't it a lovely thought that God might be waiting for there to be silence in your life in order to share some of his best secrets with you? It was a truly profound secret from God's heart to mine when, in the silence, he whispered to my soul, "You are not set aside. You are set apart." This statement settled me, changed me, and prepared me to share this same message with you. I know it can be painful to be alone. And I know the thoughts of being set aside are loud and overwhelmingly tempting to believe in the hollows of feeling unnoticed and uninvited. But as you pray through your feelings, see if maybe your situation has more to do with you being prepared than you being overlooked. There is something wonderfully sacred that happens when a girl chooses to realize that being set aside is actually God's call for her to be set apart. Sometimes, though, when God calls for us to be set apart for another purpose, it's difficult to believe God's goodness in the hurt. Have you ever cried over something so much that you run out of tears? Your swollen eyes just give out and dry up while a current of unrest still gushes through your soul? And you look up towards heaven in utter frustration? Me too. And there's someone else in the Bible who is right there as well. She felt provoked and irritated. Her anguish was so intense that she wept and would not eat. Before the Lord, she cried out in bitterness of soul, "Lord Almighty, if you will only look on your servant's misery and remember me and not forget your servant, then I will." 1 Samuel 1:11. These words describe and articulate the deep distress of a woman from thousands of years ago. And yet here I sit in modern times and I relate so completely. They are from a woman named Hannah, found in 1 Samuel 1. But you have to know that Hannah's expressions could have so easily come from me, or even you. Hannah's tears over her empty womb were made even more painful by her husband's other wife, Peninnah. She had many sons and daughters and made sure to rub this fact in Hannah's face every chance she got. In classic mean girl style, Peninnah's actions targeted Hannah in her weakest place. Because the Lord had closed Hannah's womb, her rival Peninnah kept provoking her in order to irritate her. 1:6. There's a common thread that weaves through Hannah's story, and yours and mine. We all desperately want something that we see the Lord giving to other women. We see Him blessing them in the very areas He's withholding from us. And while these other women may not be obnoxious like Peninnah in the reminders of their blessing and our lack, it's increasingly painful each time we see a reminder. We look at them and we feel set aside. Why them? Why not me? Then the seemingly unjust silence from God ushers us from a disturbed heart to weeping with bitterness of soul. And we start to feel something deep inside that comes in conflict with everything we hold true. If God is good like we talked about in chapter 2, why isn't He being good to me in this? And in this moment of raw soul honesty, we're forced to admit that we feel a bit suspicious of God. We've done all we know to do. We've prayed all we know to pray. We've stood on countless promises with a brave face, and still nothing. Have you ever been suspicious of God in this way? I'm not talking about wondering if God exists. This is not a struggle of intellectual debate peppered with facts. This is a struggle of emotional realities salted with feelings. My head long ago nodded a big yes to His existence. It's because I know He exists and I know He loves me that things get so confusing and complicated. My heart struggles to make peace between God's ability to change hard things and His apparent decision not to change them for me. In Hannah's case, we have the benefit of reading her story all the way through. And in a matter of 4 verses, 17 through 20, her cries of anguish give way to the cries of her newborn son. But 1 Samuel 1:20 uses very clear words to let me know Hannah's answer didn't come right away. So in the course of time, Hannah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. And in the course of time, things will work out for me too. And things will work out for you. In the meantime, there's one more thing to add to the humility gifts we've already discussed. Forgiving. Standing in front of the mirror, thinking about the thigh gap girl, I tucked a strand of my hair behind my ear and swallowed hard, because I just didn't know what else to do. Instead of answers, all I kept hearing in response to my heart's cry were messages on forgiveness. Like unwelcome droplets of rain on a good hair day, I kept getting hit with quotes and songs and messages on forgiving. Sadly, I felt like telling each one to go stick itself where the sun don't shine. like in my lap region void of a thigh gap. I know, I agree with you. That last emission is such evidence that awful had just eaten me up. From the top of my mind, entangled all about my heart down to the tips of my toes, I resisted forgiving. Until I saw someone write the word this way. Forgiving. God made us forgiving. God made you forgiving. God made me forgiving. And if we are forgiving, we have to see opportunities taken away differently. What if this opportunity wasn't really taken away from me? What if I was actually spared of this gift because for me it was really a burden in disguise? What if my thigh gap friend was actually doing me the greatest favor by fulfilling this assignment so I didn't have to? What if I was being set apart for something else? This is that special wisdom I mentioned in Humility Gift number 1 a few pages back. We won't think of this naturally, but if I can choose to trust that this is God's protection for me and God's provision for her, it all lands in the good category. In that, I can be all for giving this opportunity to her. I can be all for giving God the trust he so absolutely deserves. I can be all for giving myself space to back down, back away, and back off all the crazy emotions stealing my attention from the other gifts right in front of me today. Instead of rejection, I can actually rejoice. This assignment wasn't meant for me. When I am forgiving, I set us both up for winning. She gets the assignment she was made to carry. I'm freed up for other, better suited assignments tailor-made for me. And neither of us gets caught in the wake of weird emotions stemming from me feeling rejected and bitter. Of course, her toned thighs still trip me up every now and then, but I'm doing this new exercise video that I ordered from the TV, which promises to lift and tuck and melt the flab away. I bet by the time we see each other in heaven, my legs are going to be looking oh so fine. Or not. Maybe my legs were built more for stability. No gentle breeze is going to knock this girl over, that's for sure. But no matter, because that's about the time Jesus will remind us that thighs aren't something we'll ever think about in eternity. And all God's girls say, hallelujah! Chapter 10. Her success does not threaten mine. Several years ago, I remember pouring out all the best words I had in pixelated letters turned pages turned book proposal. I tucked my heart and dreams into a purple Office Max binder because nothing says I'm author material more than a purple Office Max binder, and hoped for the best. That summer, I gave my proposal to several acquisitions editors. I wanted the message I'd been working on to get into as many hands as possible, and I knew having a published book would accomplish that. These acquisitions editors held the key to making my dreams come true. For months after sending out my proposal, I would dream about the day some publishing house would say yes. I can't tell you the number of afternoons I'd stand at my mailbox holding my breath and praying there would be good news inside. When the rejection letter started coming in, I tried to keep up the hope that surely there would be one positive answer. I just needed one publisher to say yes. Soon I'd received a no from all but one, and when I got that final rejection, I felt so foolish for thinking I could actually write a book. My dream was nothing but a sham. I had no writing skills, and I must have heard God all wrong. At the same time, I had wannabe writer friends who were getting different letters from the publishers. Amazing letters, dreams come true letters, letters that turned into book contracts. In my better moments, I did the right thing and authentically celebrated with them. But then there were other moments, hard moments, moments when I felt like my friends' lives were rushing past me in a flurry of met goals, new opportunities, and affirmations of their callings from God. It seemed the world was literally passing me by. In those moments, I said good for them, but on the inside, I kept thinking, ouch. That means less and less opportunity for me. The raw essence of honest hurting rarely produces pretty thoughts. Why can't I see the kind of breakthrough she's experiencing? She's so much better connected, resourced, and talented than me. Since she's already successful with her endeavors, I wonder if there's even a need for mine. When I wrote out all these thoughts that had been running like a ticker tape in my mind, I was stunned at what I'd allowed. Not one of these statements was helpful. Not one of these statements was God-honoring. Not one of these statements acknowledged God's provision, which is big enough for all of us. Every one of these statements minimized God and maximized my weaknesses. That's not how we're supposed to think. We are supposed to maximize God, which keeps our weaknesses in perspective. This was truly foolish thinking that stunk. And if we allow our thoughts to stink, that smell will leak out of every bit of us, our words, our actions, and especially our reactions. Proverbs 23:7 reminds us, "For as he thinks in his heart, so is he." We've already unpacked a little bit of this back when we talked about the boxes of bitterness and grace. But because of how much it affects us, I think it's worth delving into a little deeper. The stink. I have an adorable little 3-pound dog named Willow. She's precious. She's sweet. I love to cuddle her. But there's one thing she does that I can't for the life of me understand. When she's freshly washed or freshly groomed, she will search our acreage for deer poop and roll in it until that horrid smell invades every inch of her. It is truly the strangest thing, and it does nothing to encourage me to want to bond with her. Nothing. I love her, but when she rolls in that stink, it not only affects her, it affects me and everyone else in our home who comes close to her. Likewise, when you and I roll around in thoughts that stink, it affects the atmosphere everywhere we go. Stinking thoughts are not only unpleasant, they hint of death and not life. As Jesus girls, we can't walk in victory while wallowing in thoughts of defeat and rejection. We must carry with us the sweet aroma of knowing Jesus everywhere we go. The Apostle Paul wrote about this in 2 Corinthians 2:14. "But thanks be to God, who always leads us in triumph in Christ, and manifests through us the sweet aroma of the knowledge of him in every place." When Paul wrote this, he had in his mind the procession that occurs with a Roman triumph. The victorious general in his chariot with his white horses, the laureled soldiers, the wreathing clouds of incense that went up into the blue sky, and the shouting multitude of spectators. As the wreathing incense appealed at once to two senses, and was visible in its curling clouds of smoke, and likewise fragrant to the nostrils, so says Paul, with a singular combination of expression, "He maketh manifest, that is visible, the savor of his knowledge. From a heart kindled by the flame of the divine love, there will go up the odor of a holy life, visible and fragrant, sweet and fair." When we know Christ, it should show in our overflow, regardless of our relative success or discouragement in the face of rejection. From our hearts, to our thoughts, to our words, to our actions, we have no business rolling in stink. As the commentary above stated, "From a heart kindled by the flame of the divine love, there will go up the odor of a holy life, visible and fragrant." We are all prone to thoughts that stink, all of us. So how do you stop the stink? I have yet to figure it out with my dog, Willow, but I have figured it out for you and me. We must stop the scarcity thinking. Scarcity versus abundance. What exactly is scarcity thinking? I like the way Stephen Covey put it in his book, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Most people are deeply scripted in what I call the scarcity mentality. They see life as having only so much, as though there were only one pie out there. And if someone were to get a big piece of the pie, it would mean less for everybody else. The scarcity mentality is the zero-sum paradigm of life. People with a scarcity mentality have a very difficult time sharing recognition and credit, power or profit, even with those who help in the production. They also have a very hard time being genuinely happy for the success of other people. The abundance mentality, on the other hand, flows out of a deep inner sense of personal worth and security. It is the paradigm that there is plenty out there and enough to spare for everybody. It results in sharing of prestige, of recognition, of profits, of decision-making. It opens possibilities, options, alternatives, and creativity. In other words, people who live with an abundance mentality, who operate out of a deep knowing of their immeasurable worth, live loved. Since Covey's book focuses mostly on dynamics in the business world, I wanted to know if the Bible ever specifically addressed an abundant approach to life versus one of scarcity, and boy, does it ever. As a matter of fact, it is woven into the very fabric of creation. Right from the beginning, God's way was an abundant way. Genesis 1 is all about God creating a good world blessed with abundant life potential tucked inside the DNA of every bit of his creation. His instruction to his creation was, be fruitful and multiply. The plants weren't limited. The animals weren't limited. People weren't limited. Inside each were seeds for more. This fruitful ability clearly speaks of God's goodness and abundance. Psalm 104, the longest creation poem, is a commentary on Genesis 1. The psalmist surveys creation and names it all, the heavens and the earth, the waters and springs and streams and trees and birds and goats and wine and oil and bread and people and lions. This goes on for 23 verses and ends in the 24th with the psalmist's expression of awe and praise for God and God's creation. Verses 27 and 28 are something like a table prayer. They proclaim, you give them all food in due season. You feed everybody. The psalm makes clear that we don't need to worry. God is utterly, utterly reliable. The fruitfulness of the world is guaranteed. Together, these scriptures proclaim that God's force of life is loose in the world. Genesis 1 affirms generosity and denies scarcity. From Genesis 1, the pattern of abundance is lived out all the way until Genesis 47. Then things change in a dramatic way. In that chapter, Pharaoh dreams that there will be famine in the land. So Pharaoh gets organized to administer, control, and monopolize the food supply. Pharaoh introduces the principle of scarcity into the world economy. For the first time in the Bible, someone says, "There's not enough. Let's get everything." By the end of Genesis 47, Pharaoh has all the land except that belonging to the priests, which he never touches because he needs somebody to bless him. The notion of scarcity has been introduced into biblical faith. The book of Exodus records the contest between the liturgy of generosity and the myth of scarcity, a contest that still tears us apart today. As I studied these scriptures, I really felt I was beginning to understand how this relates to my struggle with rejection. If I look at my dreams, desires, and hopes for the future as coming from a place of scarcity and the world's limited supply, it will constantly feed the notion that someone else's success is a threat to mine. In other words, this person getting opportunities means less opportunity for me. Pharaoh, prompted by a dream drenched in fear, processes worries through earthly thinking, unguided by God. And suddenly other people having free access to food felt like a threat to him. That's not wisdom. That's fear. That's not how we are to process life. We are to process life by looking up to the Lord and into his word for wisdom. James 3:14 through 15 says, "If you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic." What steals your heart away from God's wisdom? Might I take a tiny stab at what I think might have stolen at least a small part of you in the last hour? Social media. Wait, don't put the book down thinking I'm slamming social media. There are definitely good things happening there. But if it's stealing your heart away from God's wisdom, it's filling you with something else. This is something I know all too well. It's easy to scroll and surf through postings where people upload the beautiful, successful, shiny sides of life and quickly get a jilted notion that maybe we're not quite keeping up. We feel small, unnoticed, incapable. One day I realized I had to stop looking at things spotlighting others' successes until I had a better way of processing them. Until I could look at others and genuinely celebrate their lives without feeling anything but joy for them. I had to starve my scarcity thinking. How did I do this? I started to ask him to bless others and prayed this verse.